Thank you all for showing up. We were wondering how many people would be here for an 8 o'clock session on Record Non-Record the Saturday after the reception, or the day after the reception. So thank you all for coming. Ren Cahoon and I are going to be working back and forth as sort of a tag team on this. Our bios are up on the SAA site with this session. So if you want any details about that, please go there and take a look. We both have had, give or take, 30 years of experience in records and archives. We worked together as a team at Lockheed Martin on records management consulting, working with organizations that want to move from paper records to electronic records, including preservation, obviously Lockheed working with NARA on the ERA project. We come at it from different perspectives. Ren's background is more in data management, and he was CIO at the National Archives for 10 years, I guess, and then a senior advisor to the archivist on electronic records. I come from an archives and records background. I'm a CA, CRM. I've worked in federal agencies as a records manager, worked at the National Archives in electronic records policy and other things. So that's a bit about our background. In 1994, Richard Cox did an article in Records and Electronic and Retrieval Report called "The Record, Is It Evolving?" And it looked at the changes in records based on the transition to electronic record keeping. And that, I think, was, at least in my case, the impetus for starting to put together this presentation on non-record. Non-record and its uses and, in some cases, abuses, at least in the federal agencies we've worked with, is something that has sort of caught Ren's and my attention now for the year and a half we've been working together and some time before. This is a work in progress, and what we would like to do today is engage in a dialogue with you. One of the things we want to be able to do is talk a little bit about how this idea plays for not just federal, but state, local, not just records managers, but also archivists. So that's what we would like to talk about a bit. This is what we want to make sure we're not doing. We call this guy Domino Man, not because he delivers pizza, but because he's sitting there doing something that he thinks will have absolutely no impact on him, and eventually it will have considerable impact on him as that final domino falls. We want to make sure that we're not looking at unforeseen consequences. We're missing the consequences of de-emphasizing, which is what we're talking about, record, non-record distinction. So what we want to do this morning, quickly, is Ren will give you a background on how we got to where we are, our thinking on this from a high level. It'll come back to me, and I will talk about record, non-record definitions, how they are used, our understanding, and everybody else's on that subject. And then we'll go into implications. And we'll take some time to talk a little bit back and forth, hopefully, about your reactions to what we're saying and get your opinions on this. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ren. And pass the baton.
Thanks, Mike. And I sense the mic kicking in and out. Is it doing that again?
Yesterday.
So I wonder if I speak really loudly this way, you won't have the mic going in and out. Is that better? Rather than loud, soft. Okay, Mike talked about the domino man. We're really interested in the implications. We may get lavalier mics here, looks like. Looking at the implications of this notion of the distinction between record and non-record, and if we begin to, because the distinction blurs quite a bit, if we begin to ignore the notion of non-record, what happens? That's what we want to talk about today. So first, here's our position. Here's what the kind of the stand we're taking, and then what we want to do is engage in a conversation to see if what we're thinking continues to make sense. August 12, 1981, significant event. At that point, the whole world changed in terms of how we think about information, how we process and manage information. Does anybody know what happened on that date? I know Jason does because he's been speaking before.
That? Okay. Is that working?
Yeah.
Okay.
August 12, 1981, the IBM PC was introduced to business. And so no longer the hobbyist machine, it's now a business machine. And that business machine sat on the desks of the privileged. And soon everybody had to have one because everyone wanted to be privileged. And suddenly we have on everybody's desks PCs. Someone at Novell got the bright idea, hey, we can connect these things together. We can have a network. We can start to talk to each other. We can have file and print servers and use these machines to replace some of the work that was done on mainframes. Then someone figured out, hey, let's communicate with each other using email. Suddenly we had a whole new way of doing business, and our position is that records management just has not kept up since August 12, 1981, and we're still playing catch-up today. Twitter, instant messaging, blogs, wikis, all that technology has overwhelmed us as records and information managers and archivists. And so we think that while the principles of records management are still valid, that a lot of the practices that have been either forgotten or that we have implemented aren't sustainable in a world that is so electronic. We think that records are only a part of the information assets that an organization needs to actually function effectively. Just because something's declared a non-record doesn't mean it doesn't have significant value to the organization and isn't necessary in terms of its ability to leverage, to repurpose, to support a knowledge organization or a learning organization. So we think that all information assets basically need to be managed. That non-records may exist, but that the dichotomy at this point isn't useful to us. We believe that our definition of what needs to be managed may be sub-optimizing our organizations. By that we mean that if you think of your organization as a system, a set of parts that interact together to perform a specific function, that if the function of information management and information asset management is not optimized, then we're sub-optimizing the organization. And when we say sub-optimized, we're talking about a whole body of materials that we've decided aren't records, and so they're not being managed effectively. That ineffective management of those materials sub-optimizes the organization and the value of those assets to the organization. We think a bigger, more pressing problem than record, non-record is the lack of management of all these information assets. You know, there are content management people over here managing some stuff. We've got records management applications managing some stuff. Then there's a whole pile of stuff that falls out in the middle. Who's managing that? It's on shared drives. It's on thumb drives. It's on local drives. It's all over the place. Who's managing it? How are they managing it? And then when our legal friends decide that it's time for a lawsuit and an e-discovery request is made, then we got to find everything that's relevant, right? Whether we're managing it or not, whether we've got control of it or not, we're responsible for finding the responsive materials. Better management of information assets. Here's what we're saying. Everything ought to be managed according to ISO 15489 principles. Record, non-record, doesn't matter. Use records management principles to manage all the information assets in our organizations. And finally, how we do this in each organization depends on the business needs of the organization itself. There is no one-size-fits-all. The standards are important as guidelines, and that we need to tune how we manage our information assets based on the business needs of the organization. In other words, there's a notion of good enough records management. Obviously, there's a threshold. You know, what you do has got to be legal. Okay, but beyond meeting that legal threshold, then you manage records and information based on the needs of the organization. Okay, that's the net of what we want to talk about this morning. And so what I would like to do just for a minute or two is to just provide enough context so that you kind of get a sense for the frame of reference or the mental models that Mike and I are using to frame this conversation. Look at an organization as an ecosystem. And there are lots of different ways to look at an ecosystem of an organization. We've chosen to put records and information assets at the center. You could put your customers at the center. You could put your business processes at the center. You could look at this a lot of different ways. But the point is that each one of these elements is present in every organization. And that as records and information managers, archivists, we need to be able to think about the implications for on each of the elements of this ecosystem on decisions that we make about how we manage records and information. The ecosystem consists of records and information assets at the center, a records and information management program, business processes, and enterprise architecture as the three main supports of records and information assets. In the outer rim, I'll try and make this work here, we have people, we have IT infrastructure, governance, organization, and culture that all have a very significant influence on the RIM program, on enterprise architecture and business processes, and then consumer and community laws and regulations, our suppliers, our customers, all have additional influence, although sometimes it's a little more removed. You can't say that really about... We have to recognize the impact that each of these elements of the ecosystem has on that decision. So that's where we're starting to look for where are those unforeseen consequences. So this becomes a framework to think about and a more formalized, rigorous framework to think about how we manage our records and information assets. Does that make some sense? The kind of ecosystem notion? Okay. A lot of folks, again, another kind of mental model of ours, we don't think of records and information as having necessarily a life cycle. A life cycle to us means that something comes back on itself. We believe that there's a process that records and information assets are part of. And so we think about the creation and capture as an event, but at the point of creation and capture, there's an opportunity to leverage, share, and repurpose those assets. That doesn't come necessarily at the end of the life cycle or some point further. That can happen at the moment the record's created. It can be repurposed, leveraged, and shared. We need to think about preservation at the point of creation, not at some point farther down in its life cycle. No one's going to have time to look at terabytes of information assets to determine, how should they be preserved. We need to think about that at the even before the point of capture, at the time the enterprise architecture is developed that manages or that guides the systems that create our records and information. We need the assessment process. Is something valuable? Do we still need to keep it? Is something that happens throughout the whole life of an asset? And finally, we believe we need to manage the assets from throughout their whole life, not at any particular point. And finally, that we want to be able to search and access those materials, at the moment they're created. We need to be able to have access to them. So this records and information management process model is a major framework that's kind of guiding our thought processes. This isn't meant to overwhelm or confuse.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Well, just overwhelm.
Just overwhelm. The idea with this analysis framework is to just begin to recognize that for each kind of element of the process of managing records and information, that there are a set of theory and principles, policy standards, business processes, and system requirements that are implicated and affected by each of these elements of the life of an information asset. And it's complicated by the fact that there are many different types of information assets. Some of them are analog, some of them are digital, some of them are very complex digital objects, some of them aren't. And each we need to think about each one of these types of assets in terms of where they are in the process of records and information management, with respect to theory, principles, standards, policies, system requirements, etc. Each one of these cubes has the intersection of those three points requires us to think about what's going on and how are we going to manage those assets, with email preservation standards as an example. Okay? Finally, in terms of our framework, and with apologies to Maslow, we think there's some hierarchy of needs with respect to how we manage records and information. Many of us drowning in the digital swamp, to get out of it, we need to get physical control, after which we can get intellectual control, and then we can get some notion of what are we going to keep, what are we going to get rid of, how long are we going to keep it. Then if we're going to keep it, how are we going to keep it? And then finally, you know, we've got this stuff. How are we going to share it, reuse it, repurpose it, and exploit it? And if we don't have control, there's no way we can do these things. Does that make sense? I see. You're just causing a little bit of static in my part of the presentation. Anyway, this basically is the framework, the intellectual framework that we're using. And Mike's going to now describe how we've taken the elements of this framework and applied it to our thinking in kind of a level set. Okay?
Okay. Is this projected? Here it is. No. Okay, fine. I can do this. Is this projected? No.
You don't need it.
I don't need it. That's what they all say. We'll try this and see how it works. Yeah, I know. That's part of the problem. So in theory, the microphone is here, and it will be recorded. Excuse me. Okay. Level set. Talk a little bit about definitions. These definitions come directly from federal regulation, but they're fairly common, and a lot of folks use them. The components of a record, pretty simple. All media made or received in the course of the transaction of, in this case, public business or any kind of business, preserved or appropriate for preservation, gets a little murkier there, as evidence for information value. There are other interpretations as well, or at least additions to this. If we talk about archival theory sets a pretty high standard, actually, on what constitutes a record. We talk about authenticity, integrity, reliability, and usability over time. These are characteristics of a record that records are supposed to have based on archival theory. You want to get a little deeper into it? Look at diplomatics and all of the things, all of the characteristics records are supposed to have. We can talk about various aspects of what constitutes informational value, evidence of what. We'll get to that in just a minute. Annotations. We talk about in records that, yes, you've got one document, that's the record, you put annotations on it, that makes it a different record. What kind of annotations? Does it count if I highlight? Just some of the things that people are starting to work on. Do you have to intend to make a record?
No.
Records can happen whether you intend them or not. Some have said you do need records. Making records is an intentional process, one piece of archival theory. There are lots of variations on the definition. One of the other things that gets pitched in is official records. At EPA, I always ask, what's an unofficial record? Well, that was an unclear too. But there is a discussion of something that is the official record that an organization stands with, that is their interpretation, all of the documentation they feel they must have in order to document a transaction. How that varies from records generally, and what is the status of an unofficial record or documentation that doesn't fit official record is something, again, that's been in limbo. Non-records, a couple of things there. Enumerated items in the federal realm, stocks of publications, extra copies of meant for reference, library and museum materials, but it also says anything that doesn't qualify or meet the definition of a record, which again opens it back up. Earlier in records management, non-records were also things that were not included on a record schedule. But then textbooks started saying, well, since there's a lot of stuff that doesn't quite make it onto a schedule, even if it should be a record, they decided to take that off. There are some other unifying concepts that try to pull together record and non-record to talk about overall information assets, as we refer to them. Documentary materials is one. The National Archives has been using business assets is another one. So these are just some of the terminology that we as a profession have used. So what is your understanding of record, non-record? I would agree with that.
Exactly. I mean, I just think that's...
Well, one of the questions we actually had was, everybody buys this, so why are we talking about it? Does anybody else have a different idea? It's 8 o'clock in the morning. What in the world is this guy asking questions like that for? Yes? That is a very good observation. When I teach classes, I usually say observations that take me to the next slide get an A. Observations that take me to or take you to Ren's part of the presentation, that's a different thing. But the point is right on. Was there a hand back there for one more? The question of litigation, and the comment was that records are anything that could be called for in litigation, gets you into the varying definitions of what constitutes a record in states, the federal level, et cetera, et cetera. I think our response, while we would agree that those things are records, we would caution that that doesn't mean that things you can't get at in litigation are not records, because there are things that are excluded from access requirements that still may qualify as records. And our argument would be that they are information assets and need to be managed. One more.
In my world, anyway, if it's called up in litigation, it doesn't need to be a record. I work for Ford Motor Company, and a crashed automobile needs to be saved for litigation purposes. I wouldn't call it a record.
That's correct.
Others might, depending on how deeply you delve into the theory. But I have become more and more convinced that this distinction is not very useful, in part because our users, the people who have less and less resources to do the work we're asking them to do, have to sit there and think about what's a record and what's not a record. And it's not useful use of their time. And it doesn't matter in the long run, because what comes up in litigation can be non-record. Sorry.
One more.
The organization I work for, it's the retention schedules that I'm going to be making are permanent because everything builds on past research. So it's research. You can't really call it a record or a non-record. This is archaeology, it's anthropology, it's all of that. And history.
I think what I would draw out of this is that in many cases, the examples of non-record, and this comes from the, again, federal regulation, many of these things, if you look at them and you start thinking about both the needs of the organization, how you organize material, whether or not you can file it at the moment of creation, whether or not you know at the moment of creation what it is, what its life is going to look like, most of these can, in fact, provide evidence of something depending on the organization, depending on the specific thing that is being documented. It gets murky, and I think that's been our basic argument here. There was an interesting article in American Archivist, actually a pair of them by Jeffrey Yeo, I believe that's the way to pronounce his name, on what is a record. And he looks at all the various kinds of things that are records and spends a good bit of time trying to come up with a definition. If we as a profession have that much trouble coming up with a definition of record, coming up with a definition of non-record is also going to be difficult. But what he says, and this is a very interesting way to think about it, and I would do the same for non-record, is thinking in terms of prototypes. Think of a bird. Everybody has an image of a bird. What's it look like? He says, lots of people think of robins, fine. Not too many people think of ostriches. They are birds technically, but they're sort of off here. Penguins are over here. Turkeys and chickens are up here. And we can think about it as a topology of shared characteristics or characteristics that are not shared all that much. And the same thing is true, I think, in records. Most of us would say that catalogs, trade journals that require no action probably do not constitute record material in the traditional sense. Tickler files might be different. Information copies, depending on the way they are used, may be different. So that's the point there. Lots of examples here. I'm not going to go into them individually, but these are things that some people have suggested to be non-record. I think our argument would be that many of these provide minimally contextual information that help us understand how things take place in an organization. Whether it's gatherings of those things by a person for a purpose, that is, it helps explain, it provides context for whatever that purpose is. As someone said earlier, or I think as you mentioned for Ken Thibodeau, the question is not whether it's a record, it's how long does it need to be kept both by the individual and the organization to document what's going on. If it's the way George W. Bush is gathering things on his desktop, that's one thing. If it's the way I'm doing it, that's probably something else. One of the things that's interesting, and it comes out of the new federal regulations out for comment by the National Archives, is this statement that I think gets at the heart of why record, non-record doesn't make a whole lot of difference anymore. Talking about multiple copies. Multiple copies of documents and documents containing duplicative information may each have record status depending on their relationship to other records, their context, and how they are used. But it's the piece on context and the amount of that kind of information that can provide context that we think is quite important. Gray areas in the definition, I think we've already talked about most of these. And I think these are things that the profession, if we're going to keep record, non-record, would have to be a lot more clear on. The point that has been made, and I think it was a good point that was made previously, is these are not things that the average records creator understands. The average records creator can think about how long he or she needs to keep something, how it fits into the work they are doing, but if you ask them to move out of their mindset into record, non-record, that provides them with problems. Two examples. I was at a conference at the Environmental Protection Agency. We were talking about systems development and the implementation of a new application that they were working on. And these folks got on to, well, what will we put in the system? And everybody agreed that all of the documents under discussion were useful to the organization and necessary for preservation, but some didn't belong in this system because they were not records. This went on for 20 minutes among professionals who knew nothing about records management or archives, but had very definite opinions on what had to go into a record-keeping system, quote unquote. Was anybody at the Records Management Roundtable? Very interesting discussion there by an archivist for a Native American organization who had to deal with the fact that the Native American culture was oral, and how do you explain what a record is in an oral environment? We have the same kind of thing. It's not an oral organization that we're working with. These people create lots of documentation, but they don't think of it in terms of record, non-record. So if we can move, as the Native American archivist did, to try to explain things in their terms rather than trying to force those folks into our terms, I think it would be helpful. A lot of things we can say here about how we got to where we are. I think a lot of the origins of record, non-record had to do with the desire of records managers and archivists back in the 50s to reduce the burden on everyone. There are things here that we don't have to manage. There are things we can put aside. Archivists do not have to worry about appraising them. Although, at least in the federal sector, agencies are expected to manage that documentation. The basic guidance provided is manage it by separating it from record material. But there is an expectation that it's to be managed. Constraints, assumptions. At one time, there were people who actually were expert in figuring out what needed to be filed and what didn't. These were called admin staff. These were called file clerks. These were called people who had records management central repositories for organizations. They could make these decisions. They were skilled at it. That's what they got paid to do. Those people went away with automation. It's now up to everybody being his or her own records manager, which is a scary thought. And I think the question then becomes for us, given the way, and Ren will talk about the changes in a lot more detail, given that, what do we want to do? Do we want to focus on having people make that correct decision about record, non-record, or do we want to take another approach? Record and non-record may be okay in theory. I mean, I can understand why there is a theoretical basis for doing this, but these are the common views. And one of the things, anybody who's done any records management knows, most offices you go into and talk to individuals, they have no records. They have working files that are not records, but they have no records. That's because if they have records, records belong to the organization, and they have to manage them according to some kind of external guidelines. Non-records are mine. I can do whatever I want to with them. So the idea of stewardship, they don't like. They don't like being stewards of other people's stuff. They like being owners, so they can do with it whatever they want. And the final thing, if it's not a record, there's no real need to manage it. Incorrect, even from an organizational perspective, but a common misperception. So, why is this important? I think it's important for a number of reasons that we list up here. If people are thinking in terms of record, non-record, that is the mental model they have. The first thing I have to decide is it a record or isn't it? And after that, it goes two different ways according to management. That means that they are not looking at focusing on information assets that must be managed. They're focused on what are the information assets I have to manage and what can I kick off my plate. The uneven application, and we've talked a number of places about the fact that different places have different cultures, different understandings of what is a record. Uneven application results in poorer records and increased organizational vulnerability. And generally speaking, if it's not a record, records managers and archivists won't get involved. And there are things that we will never see as part of the documentation of the organization. So, can do a couple of things here. We've had a little bit of interaction. We can spend some time talking about what's been presented up to this point. And if this is something that most folks seem to agree on, it makes sense. We can move on to what are the implications for the ecosystem, and then what are the implications for archives and records managers that we see. So, are there any thoughts?
In other words, what do you want to do?
What do you want to do? I want to get coffee. Did you want to respond to that, or?
Why don't you start, and then I'll follow.
Okay. The thing that we do see here, and that was one of the examples of things that might be non-records, in theory, yes, that transcript where you pull everything together and find some way to freeze it, everybody agrees that that's a record. What about all the stuff that's out there that's being pulled from? And that's one of the places where people say either, yes, it's a record, or no, it isn't. There's a lot of feeling databases aren't records, transactions are records, that sort of thing. Our argument is that whatever you want to call it, it needs to be managed. There needs to be a protection of it for privacy considerations. There needs to be retention. There needs to be an ultimate disposition. And fretting over whether it's a record or not is a lot of people spinning their wheels. And that's why we feel that this dichotomy and looking at it with that kind of mental model doesn't help any of the professions or the organizations we work for. In the blue, please.
That's great. That's visionary, frankly, because now you're leveraging those information assets in a way that really extracts the value of them for the whole organization throughout their whole life, for example, rather than waiting to the end and then deciding to share them. And the fact that individuals don't have to make any upfront decisions about what am I going to do with this stuff, I think is huge. I saw other questions. I don't know, Jason, you had one? Or comment?
I would like to know where you're going with this, though, because if you're calling for words matter. So if you're calling for the Federal Records Act to be changed to the Federal Information Act, then I want to hear that as the end point of the lecture. I think the Congress is aware, and the point that was made by litigation was exactly right. Lawyers don't care about records so much. They'll take records, but then they'll take everything else. And the new term of art is electronically stored information.
Yep.
That every lawyer in the country needs to know. Secondly, the Representative Waxman in pushing, and now the House passing the Electronic Message Preservation Act, EMPA, which has not passed the Senate, says that email and other electronic records need to be preserved in RMAs. But the act is called the Electronic Message Preservation Act, not, it's not records in the title. So are you calling for here the abandonment of the term records in replacement of some larger concept?
I don't think, at least from my perspective, I can say I'm not calling for changing the Federal Records Act to the Federal Information Act. I do not think, first of all, I don't think it would get any place. But what I would say is, if one looks at the new revised National Archives regulations, there is a tremendous emphasis on record, non-record within the regulations. If we could get away from the the focus on that as the way to approach information management, yes, it exists, yes, there are things that are non-records, fine, we'll leave that alone, and now can we focus on managing electronically stored information using records management tools, which we feel are very good for managing all kinds of information, whether it fits the definition of a record in your jurisdiction or industry or not. I think that's where I think we're going, at least I am.
What would you like to see?
I'm actually relatively simpatico with that. I mean, I just, I think that's well stated, Mike. I'm a little more sanguine about maybe changes in nomenclature. I do think words matter. So, I mean, the Federal Records Act is the definition of a record, machine-readable record, you know, it's 58 years now. It hasn't been changed. Maybe there should be some lobbying for some improvements in the definition in 44 U.S.C. 3301.
When I retire the next time, I'll work on that.
Elizabeth.
I just wanted to add that you're talking in a direction I've been thinking for a while, and I'm very interested to see where you're going as well, simply because I'm sort of at the point where I'm coming to the same conclusion, but haven't figured out how to move on to the next step. And for something like email, where really so much of it is junk, and only a little bit of it has any value at all, that sort of declaration point still seems somewhat important. And I haven't quite figured out how to work that within this context.
I think if I could respond to that just briefly, I think it's important to whom, important for what. And there, all of a sudden, people have realized that those emails back and forth between the broker and the client about what to buy and what to sell are extremely important. And I don't know, and I think this is a point that we've talked about a little bit, you don't necessarily know at the point of creation what the potential uses of that information are. That's why I tend to look at it as their information assets. We will know down the road what they're important for. I mean, even if it's, quote, personal email, I don't know what you as archivists would do if you were the archivist of the city of Detroit with the with the messages on the PDA of the mayor and his significant other after he had said, I have no affair with this woman. All of a sudden, there is evidence. Is that something that you would accession into your archives? It's technically not government business, but it's very interesting. Would you, and other things like that, I mean, what use, perhaps, are the list of people on my buddy list for IM as opposed to everybody else in Lockheed Martin? If you were looking at me as, how did I develop an idea like this, you might want to know who's there and who isn't. I mean, there are lots of potential uses for these things that it's hard to know at the beginning. That's what I would say.
See, let me
we'll
go
never
back.
Get to where we're going.
That's okay. Which is that's why
that's
we wanted to have this conversation. Go ahead.
What?
Absolutely. I think that's a broadly held belief. Let's go all the way to the back, and then we'll come up front again.
And that's
one of the. You're exactly right. That's one of the huge changes, frankly, in the environment, in this ecosystem that we're working in, is that there's the death button. If you don't declare it a record, it's not managed. It's, you know, so in a lot of cases, it's just sitting out there. That doesn't necessarily mean it's deleted. It just means it's not being managed. It's exactly or a lawsuit, or it's just filling that digital landfill or the digital swamp. Oh, it has a huge implication, and I think what we're saying is that everything needs to have a retention established for it. That whether you call it a record or an elephant, you need to decide how long you're going to keep it.
I think if I could just quickly, there are a couple of ways to do that. In theory, you've got, quote, official records that are the documentation of a transaction that Kraft Food is going to take to the bank. And after that, you've got working files. Individuals have working files of various kinds to do various things. Working files, in my view, are records. And the question then becomes, do you organize them by transaction, or do you let the individual keep the working files for as long, not as long as he or she wants to, but for a period of time, 3 to 5 years? One of the things, an interesting presentation, I guess it was at Managing Electronic Records in Chicago, organization found that if you let people keep their stuff for 3 years, they'd be willing to get rid of it, rather than trying to save it off someplace else. And to control the material, they found it easier to have everybody keep their stuff for 3 years and then be willing to get rid of it. That doesn't help necessarily if you're in an organization that wants to get rid of stuff for litigation as quickly as possible. That's a different issue. Then you might want to cut it finer. But if you are comfortable with that and what you want to be able to do is necessarily find the stuff, then it would work. I think it would work.
We've got a question here in the back, and then we'll get back to Elizabeth.
I come from a provincial jurisdiction in Canada, and we're operating under archives legislation that has one definition of what a public record is. And then we find we have freedom of information legislation that has slightly variant version of what a record is. So we've essentially concluded that all public records have to be managed. And what we've done is, in other jurisdictions have done this too, we've created a common schedule for transitory records. That's what a lot of people used to call non-records as distinct from official records. We try not to use the term official records anymore because the Act essentially defines what a public record is. So even if it's a record of temporary or short-term value, which is what a transitory record is, we have to have a record schedule that lays out and defines the various categories of transitory records. And we are asking public servant users to define what their records are. They have to declare them as transitory or not.
Elizabeth?
At Ford, maybe we were ahead of the game, but at the time it was just because we were ignoring regular records management theory. we set up a system which distinguished between official and transient records, and non-records were thrown into the definition of transient records.
Mm-hmm.
And so, at Ford, basically, we have a 3-year retention for transient. It used to be 1 year, but we found out that people were completely ignoring our requirements, and that if we made it 3 years, we could actually get them to follow our requirements, which would be less troublesome in court. In that perspective, our requirements are that they will be managed by getting rid of them after 3 years. But I think part of the problem there is that there is a whole mass of data that also needs to be managed that doesn't fit the definition of official record or transient record, and that is also creating issues for us in terms of how we manage our information at Ford. And that's the part where, you know, getting away from defining a record or a non-record, but all of it needs to be managed. Certainly with databases, our take on databases is that there are records that are contained in databases, and when you decommission an application, you have to keep the records that are part of those databases. That requires real teamwork between ourselves and IT
folks
to figure out what's the record and what's not record.
Right.
There's still a universe out there in terms of things that we try to ignore but can't, like voicemail. And we have a new technology in Ford vehicles called Sync, which is managing information of the people who buy our cars.
Oh, yeah.
That has privacy considerations. And anyway, so yeah, lots of twists and turns here.
And it's fascinating how the introduction of information technology into the business processes really does change the way we work. And our position is that at the time that technology is introduced or new applications are introduced is the time to think about the implications of the introduction of those technologies into the business process on how you're going to manage the information that comes out of those business processes. It's too late, 3 years down the road, and someone says, how are we going to deal with this? You have to build it into the design, into the architecture of the applications themselves. We've got about
7 minutes.
Seven minutes left. This is the work in progress. we think there are answers. We just don't know what they are yet. I think that we've talked about many of these things already, and rather than spend our last 7 minutes talking about changes in the workplace, we recognize all these things are happening. Costs are being shifted. From people into technology, there are a lot fewer people around who are thinking about how to manage records and information. And we really believe that it's time for the records people to take a broader perspective, get a seat at the table with the enterprise, your enterprise and segment architecture staff, with your CIO staff. We've been marginalized as records managers in many, many cases, not in all, but in many cases because of this record-non-record distinction. We think it's time for that to go by the wayside, get at the table, so you're talking about managing all those information assets, giving them a retention, decide what they're going to be retained for, how long they're going to be retained. Okay. Mike, I want to be sure we get to the implications for archivists.
Okay.
So we'll real quickly just say that we think the potential impact is we can eliminate the confusion and misunderstanding about record and non-record, refocus a discussion on management of assets rather than record status, reduce the complexity, simplify the process significantly, at least in terms of some of the human dimensions of this, reduce the confusion between records policy and the realities of the legal system, and finally ensure that records management officers and archivists have a seat at the table to look at how all information assets are managed. So, Mike, let's just do that.
Okay. This is your chance to tell us if we're correct or not on what we see as implications for archivists. First off, obviously, it's going to be somewhat unclear because a lot of the stuff that is going to be moved to transitory records or whatever we want to call it is never going to come to an archival institution. But I think the question gets down to looking at your own institution and what are you trying to collect? What is your mandate? Is it activities of a government or your organization focusing on official activities? Are you more interested or equally interested in accountability and transparency? If you're interested in accountability and transparency, we get into things like the mayor's PDA stuff and emails. A lot of what we're looking for in accountability shows up in stuff that is not going to ever be captured in the official record. It's going to be back and forth among folks talking about stuff that isn't going to be official government transaction. Providing information to researchers. Those of you who might have been at the session on archival meaning, talked about the usefulness of records that were not overly processed because the rougher records that contained a lot of material that wasn't part of the official stuff gives the researcher a chance to go, as the speaker said, against the grain and start looking for things that aren't fully documented or aren't even meant to be documented in the official record. The other thing is thinking in terms of what researchers can use in terms of electronic records. Going through emails without having gone through the is it a record or isn't it, looking at emails and saying, The FBI never thought a bit about Osama bin Laden before 9/11. That's not true, having worked at the FBI, but it's that kind of thing of what is on the minds of the individuals in an organization. What's on their radar screen? Not tied to a specific transaction or a specific piece of business, but just generally, where is their head? What are they thinking about? Different kinds of things that we can do. What is your greater fear? Traditionally, working in paper records, a lot of what I hear from archivists and a lot of what I felt was you got to make it as clean as possible so that they don't have to sift through as much stuff. They want to be able to find stuff easily. You want to be able to provide stuff easily. In electronic form, it may be different. Searching is a lot easier. Not perfect. We all know the limitations to electronic searching. But folks are used to going through a lot of stuff. Thinking about what it is exactly they're willing to look through, what exactly they want to find. And do we want to require that electronic records be organized and managed the way we have traditionally done paper records? Records management has always wanted to make the file categories so that there is less than 3/4 of an inch of records in a single file folder. You can do a lot better electronically. Do we need to rethink our entire question of file plans and how we organize our records, because now we have a different way of approaching it? That's the sort of thing that we're thinking about for possible impact. Impact on appraisal. My personal feeling, having worked as an archivist for a good bit of time, is that a lot of stuff is in what would be considered to be either marginal material or things that many folks would not consider to be records if you ask them to file it as a record or not, really enriches the whole record from a research point of view. What are we doing? Oh, we're over. Anyway, so these are some examples. Telephone logs, emails to a spouse, love interest, all of these things. Who they talk to, who they don't talk to. Who do they email, who don't they? So the final question, and then we'll leave it there. Do you want top-level officials or their admins making a record, non-record decision? As an archivist thinking about your researchers, where do you want to come down on that? I'm not saying that, you know, there's one size fits all, but that's where we are. I think we're out of time, unfortunately. Thank you all for coming. And we'll be around for a few minutes.